Happy Wednesday, and thank you for joining me today. It is good to be back. In 1972, the U.S. held the midterm elections. It was the year after that, in 1973, that the winners of the 1972 midterm election were sworn into Congress in their respective, you know, races across the country. And it was around that time that a young senator from Pennsylvania that had just gotten elected, a new young senator in 1973, decided that for one of his first major moves as a new rookie senator, that he was going to go to Israel, that he was going to take a trip and fly to Israel to meet with the prime minister. Now, this was a big deal at the time because you are newly elected. You barely have any credibility at this point. You know, what was this guy doing going to meet with the Israeli prime minister, especially being that they're one of our major allies? So that was his first time going. New rookie senator, just got elected in 1972, heads to Israel in 73. 9 years later, though, he comes back. And he comes back with more prestige and credibility because this time he's the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee. He holds more prominent titles. And so when he comes back, at this point, he's already, you know, one of the most vehement supporters of Israel in the U.S. Senate. But when he comes back for the second meeting, the second time, he wanted to talk about bolstering their military and providing them with financial assistance. Not only that, but he stood up and gave a very impassioned, you know, very passionate speech about defending Israel's actions in Lebanon, including the murders of women and children. Again, this is a relatively new senator. And this was particularly concerning and extreme regarding the fact that Israel, in fact, did invade Lebanon for absolutely no conceivable reason. More than 49,000 Palestinians and Lebanese citizens ended up dying in that war, ended up being killed. Just incredulous actions and literal genocide committed across the border. And this new rookie senator is supporting that. He is saying that, yeah, we ought to be doing stuff like that. You know, and if I were in your shoes, I'd do the exact same thing. And so the Israeli prime minister that this new rookie senator met in his first year in office, literal months in office, the Israeli prime minister, a war criminal himself, basically comes out of his mouth and says to this new rookie senator, you know, basically, you know, I agree for the most part with what you're saying at the fundamental basic level in terms of the worst of humanity. But on the other coin, on the flip side, you're kind of too extreme for me, dude. You know, I mean, that's basically what he's saying here. He's basically said to this new rookie senator from Pennsylvania that you are too extreme for me. Your ideologies are just too far. But nevertheless, this guy continued. He continued speaking. He continued giving vehement speeches in support of Israel. And that U.S. senator, who so staunchly and vociferously supported Israel's worst and most despicable actions against the human race, who supported and advocated for the murders of women and children, saying, yes, we ought to be doing that. We ought to be doing what Israel is doing in Lebanon. That new senator was a guy named Joe Biden, the newly elected gentleman from Pennsylvania.
It's about time we stop those of us who support, as most of us do, Israel in this body, for apologizing for our support for Israel. There's no apology to be made. None. It is the best $3 billion investment we make. Were there not an Israel, the United States of America would have to invent an Israel to protect her interest in the region.
Quote, were there not an Israel, the United States would have to invent an Israel to protect her interest in the region. End quote. So that is in 1986 on the floor of the U.S. Senate, and that was certainly not the end of it. Once again, this is after Biden's second visit to Israel. Biden's support of Israel included their disproportionate use of force, their barbaric punishments, and outright executions. Almost two decades later, in 2001, when the Bush administration criticized Israel for targeted assassinations, Biden clapped back. He said that those weren't assassinations at all, and that the U.S. should not be condemning the Israelis in public. In 2006, he supported Israel's second war in Lebanon and their massive bombings in Gaza. Senator Biden said that they were doing the right thing in both places. He also claimed Jerusalem was the capital of Israel, which is 100% false, according to history and also the facts. He went on to defend Israel's atrocities in public, including the Mediterranean Sea murders, which the United States said was an extra-legal summary execution. Although, Biden, you know, of course, he said otherwise. So that's his track record throughout his career, from a young politician in 1973 to now the President of the United States. And with that history in mind, with that very, very recent history in mind, from a rookie U.S. senator who takes his very first trip internationally to Israel to meet with the prime minister, to now the President of the United States, it was no surprise that he would diametrically defend Israel again. And for the second time in this administration, ignored the massive genocide of Palestinians. You may recall in 2021, when this same exact thing happened, there was an 11-day war between Israel and Palestine. When this same exact thing happened, the U.S. vetoed an international call by the UN, the United Nations, for a ceasefire, which means calling for peace. And although one was eventually reached, it was heavily criticized. And now this time around, after Israel's poaching and teasing and unscrupulous crimes and slaughter, Hamas invaded the neighboring country, and this never-ending war started once again. This is on October 7th of this year. Hamas, of course, being a terrorist organization that Israel created, but no one wants to say that. It is very much there in the history. We here at the Jeremiah Patterson Show did a special report on the history of this war 2 months ago, explaining how this dates all the way back to 1948. This is not new. We also essentially talk about, you know, just because you're seeing a hashtag Free Palestine on social media, that doesn't mean that this is new. This is a recurring war in which Israel systematically murders and continues to deliberately bomb and displace the Palestinians who have been living in that hell for the past 75 years. And, you know, as a nation that claims itself to be the pillar and the pillar defender of human rights, you'd expect us to condemn something like this, right? Well, not exactly, at least not unilaterally, as it all boils down to one thing, and, you know, several things, in fact. But one of the major contributions as to why we're not full stop saying this is wrong is because of oil. If anyone ever tells you that, you know, oil isn't such a big deal, they're lying to you, because that's literally how the world functions. Oil has bought corrupt politicians. Oil is an infectious parasite. Not even that. It's an epidemiological calamity within American politics. You know, some of your favorite politicians are cashing in on lobbying for oil. It literally buys everything. And that's also the case with Israel. Because Israel is already our top trading partner with an annual bilateral trade of nearly $50 billion in goods and services, according to Vox.com. And as soon as I saw that, I immediately knew that, you know, we had strong interest in Israel for oil. And it's true, because Israel holds 13,953,000 barrels of oil as of 2016, ranking 87th in the world. But in addition to that, our current president calls Benjamin Netanyahu, the corrupt prime minister of Israel, his best friend. So nothing is going to conceivably change, at least not in the meantime, at least not even in the recent future. Because on both sides here, Democrats and Republicans, there is a largely support for Israel. And at the same time, you have to put your morality above your money and political interest, because if you say you support Palestine, you are not being anti-Semitic. It doesn't mean you hate Jews. It doesn't mean, you know, you want Israel to be gone. You want them to be attacked. No. Basically, what this, and this gets into the whole thing where people are presenting these two false narratives. You know, either if you support Israel, you're for the Jews. If you support Palestine, you're against the Jews. No, that's not what this war is about. It means that you just want Israel to back off here. Also, give the Palestinians their land back, because they are innocent and they are continuously under assault. Even when this war is not in the headlines or trending on TikTok or YouTube or social media platforms, it is still a day-to-day war for the lives of Palestinians each and every single day. This is something that they go through daily. this continuous, rapid degradation and discrimination against their people for 75 years now. We cannot keep creating, you know, these dangerous false narratives like this, because it does, in fact, present a false pretense. It does, in fact, present a false case in which you have to support something that you do not entirely stand for. The truth of the matter here is that there is no exculpatory evidence that says Israel is the victim, because it's not. And quite frankly, the leaders of the top democracies in the world should stop pretending like it is. There are 75 years of history here that proves otherwise, yet we continue to look the other way. We continue to look the other side and just support what our politicians are saying because we cannot think for ourselves, because we cannot do research. We cannot get off of, you know, just looking at like a 30-second TikTok on what's happening in the world and actually, you know, find out for ourselves. The Intercept is a nonprofit news organization objectively covering this war with facts, history, and deep reporting unlike any other network. They are doing really fantastic journalism without fear or favor, and it is worth the while. It was about 4 weeks ago that they dropped this bombshell of an article with some historical context. Quote, Biden's legacy should be forever haunted by the names of Gaza's dead children. Biden's support for the terror bombing of Gaza continues his long history as a steadfast supporter of Israel's greatest crimes. End quote. So they say that in numerous situations, even when Israel unleashed gratuitous violence, drawing international condemnation, Biden served as the country's top contender. Not even a contender at this point. He served as the country's most prominent American defender. Prepare yourself for this. This is in the article. It goes on to say, quote, in an alternate reality, one where the rule of law is applied equally to all states, Israeli leaders would likely face war crime charges for the razing of Gaza. Leading genocide scholars and international law experts have cited the statements of Israeli officials about the aims of their operations in Gaza as potential evidence of genocidal intent. A coalition of international lawyers representing Palestinian rights groups has already petitioned the International Criminal Court to open a criminal inquiry and issue arrest warrants for Netanyahu and other officials. Such attempts at accountability should not focus solely on Israeli leaders, according to some U.S. constitutional law organizations. The U.S. is Israel's premier bankroller and arms dealer, not to mention its political defender. There are several U.S. laws and treaties that prohibit support for and failure to prevent genocidal activities. Among these is the Genocide Convention Implementation Act, signed into law in 1988. Its sponsor, not so much a rookie senator anymore, a senator named Joe Biden. End quote. So you see the trail here, right? 1972, U.S. has their midterm elections. 1973, Biden goes to Israel as a new rookie senator. He then goes back 9 years later. 1988, we have this bill here, the Genocide Convention Implementation Act, signed into law by Joe Biden. Literally knowing what he knows, he supports this. I mean, I told you to prepare yourself. This is a doozy of an episode. It's much heavy in terms of the history and the impact. So Biden gets to Washington in 73. That same year, he goes to Israel again and again. And then knowing what he knows and defending it, he sponsors this type of legislation, which is diametrically antithetical to everything that he so strongly stands for, and openly supporting the genocide of hundreds of thousands of innocent Palestinian civilians. Whew. So, I mean, like, there is just a lot to unpack here. Because, firstly, when it comes to the situation right now, where Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, of course, reelected, we are contending with the fact that, yes, he is a corrupt prime minister, and literally on trial in certain things such as, you know, corruption, lots and lots of corruption, Benjamin Netanyahu, Israel's prime minister, is now seeking to dismantle the judicial system. There have been large protests against that. And so essentially declaring himself an authoritarian. And so you are leading the country at a time like this while you're also on criminal charges and, you know, prospectively prosecutorial trials for your corruption, and you're the leader of a country that is in charge of something as grave as this. I mean, conflict of interest all across the board. So we have this right-wing government in Israel basically talking to a country that has no democracy, a country that was much larger than what it was, a country that should be much larger than it is today, a country known as Palestine that was stripped to just this one region now known today as Gaza. If you look just at the comparison pictures, I mean, it's stunning. Palestine 1948, Palestine 1975, Palestine 2001 to Palestine 2023, now just known today as Gaza, essentially, because it's been stripped that bare. But what is not lost to history here, what will not be lost to history when this time in our life is written, when this time is written in the history books, what will not be lost to history is the fact that the United States supported this. The U.S. president at the time supported this. And I know it's to say, oh, well, you know, other presidents have supported Israel as well. But we are living in a time now where the political tide has shifted 360 degrees. We are living in a time now where the information, you know, channel has shifted 360 degrees. Times are not like as they used to be. We now have social media. It is not just the three channels on a certain, you know, time zone in your area. We have social media. Information is publicly and widely accessible quickly with just the tap of your fingertip. And this here has major fallback, not just politically, of course, but also in terms of where the world views us internationally. The Center for Constitutional Rights in a 44-page document said that there is credible basis to be made here that Biden is supporting genocide and can be held accountable for it. It wasn't too long after that document, was reported and was released that we showed our true colors once again. The U.S., you know, essentially vetoing a U.N. Security Council resolution that would condemn all violence against civilians and urge humanitarian aid to Palestinians in Gaza. Why? Because there was no reference to Israel having the right to defend themselves. Right. The same argument we always make. Well, I mean, do the Palestinians have a right to defend themselves? Do the women and children of a territory that used to be much larger, now only known today as Gaza, who are consistently and incessantly bombed and murdered and slaughtered and executed, do they have a right to also defend themselves? More than 16,000 Palestinians are dead as of today. Multiple scholars just coming out and just vociferous condemnation of the Biden administration and basically saying, hey, you're complicit in this by sending arms to Israel and continuing to fund them as this war continues for 62 days now. A State Department official resigned from the Biden administration saying that, hey, we're basically sending Israel the weapons to murder Palestinians. We are basically sending them the ammo ourselves. And they're not using this war to defend themselves. They're using this to deliberately slaughter women and children. They're using this to go after civilians. More than 16,000 Palestinians are dead as of today. And who's to say that it's going to stop? Because they've got a best friend in the White House. After all, they've already flexed what they can do and have continued to do under an administration that will do nothing about it. Jamar Jabari, the host of the Voices of Change podcast, he joins me next. Stay with us. Welcome back. Our next guest is someone who has over 15 years of experience in activism and studying political and international affairs. Jamar Jabari is the host of the podcast Voices of Change. He is also the co-host of the podcast Humming Nation Politics. Jamar Jabari is an absolutely an incredible person in terms of seeing things clear-eyed and understanding things and just giving you the truth and the perspective raw. He has a very perspicacious way when he speaks, and he is a person that when he speaks, you will listen because his voice just commands that in terms of the power and the credibility of what he says and the truth in his words. This is an interview that I did yesterday, and the full interview is going to be on YouTube, but I wanted to give you just a portion of it here on the Jeremiah Patterson Show. I'm going to let this run through, no commercials. All right, here it is. Joining me now for the interview is Jamari Jabari, host of the Voices of Change podcast. Mr. Jabari, thank you so much for coming on the show.
No problem. Thank you so much for having me.
So I want to firstly start off where I began the show in the introduction with President Biden's support of basically what Israel is doing in terms of genocide. And this has been going on for, you know, well over, you know, 75 years at this point. What do you make of the fact that the president is going along with this as well as many other Democrats within the party? You know, the president calls, you know, the prime minister of Israel his best friend. Just what do you make of those moves?
So I think Biden has a Cold War mindset still. A lot of these politicians, from my experience with studying them throughout the years, that people that have this idea of just being the best thing that can ever happen for humanity to them. Neocons, basically. Mm-hmm. Biden is a full-on neocon. I remember during the Obama administration how he was promoting the Iraq war. He voted for it as much as people, not the Biden administration, during the Bush administration. During the Biden administration, he was actually doing things in Ukraine, which totally different conversation, but he has always been the guy that was for war 24/7. He does not feel bad at all about what's going on. He has said starkly before any of this happened in the beginning of the year that he is a Zionist, and Christian Zionists are the hugest supporters, not Jewish people. Christian Zionists are the hugest supporters. They promote this issue that Israel has to exist. And then you have the Jewish Zionists as well too, which are in the government, and the settlers, whoever, there's a lot of settlers that disagree with their government. So I'm not going to say all settlers, but Christianity here in the United States, there is a huge group of Christians that are Zionists that outweigh the Jewish Zionists. And Biden is one of them. So Biden, it's not surprising for me, knowing his policies mm-hmm. for years, that he is supporting Israel. And he only feels blowback because he's noticing that this is destroying his reelection opportunity. If he didn't have a reelection opportunity, he'll probably not care if this was his second term. But it's a very big embarrassment to be a one-term president. It's all about ego with these guys. These guys are very egoistic. So he is definitely not surprising me at all with his support for Bibi. And he's also sending Hellfire missiles there as we speak. So mm-hmm. he's trying to get a bill passed for over $100 billion for Ukraine and also for Israel. So he's going to keep doing that while also saying that he cares about the Palestinians. That's all he's going to say. I care about the Palestinians, but I'm going to be sending missiles and stuff over there so they can kill you guys. That's basically what he's doing. He's mm-hmm. two-faced.
And just based off of that, you know, politically speaking, You know, in terms of popularity around the nation where Americans view this, I mean, we are not living in the age where it was like the Vietnam War, where you had like bare access to information. Even though like a lot of it was on TV at the time, we're now living in the age where you can instantly get things. And so like Americans aren't stupid. They know the truth here that Israel is, you know, diabolical in what they're doing here. But to have a president be so, you know, consistent and vociferous about his support for them, do you feel as if the damage is already done, even if you try to, you know, basically, I guess, clean up your statements before re-election, you know, because Americans have already seen your view?
So I want to say the damage is always done, is already done. I want to say that. But the issue is that I don't know how people are going to vote. But what I do see is that the Muslim population, which I stand in solidarity with, have already said they are not going to be supporting him. And I hope that they stick to that. My former party, which I spent almost 10 years with, I'm on a hiatus right now from advocacy with them, but the PSL has always been the center of grassroots. We are the youngest and the most biggest party for a third party in the United States of America. So we have seen countless times of the Muslim population, upset at what's going on. And these presidents still get reelected, but the outrage that I'm seeing right now is definitely different because we're seeing a genocide here that is before our eyes. It's comparable to if we had social media during the time when the Spanish conquistadors rolled into town, Columbus, the Pilgrims, the when the British was conquering the world, basically. So we're seeing that now. And this is going to hit different. So I really, really am hoping that we show at the ballot box exactly why he effed up.
In terms of when this war started exactly, I'm a person that advocates for getting your information from credible sources and actually reading articles. But one of the things that I was struck by on social media was that people were almost presented with this false narrative. It's like, if you don't support Israel, you're anti-Semitic, you hate Jews.
Right.
And I was like, no, that's not what this is about. Like, the history was very like not told. People didn't know exactly what was going on. So with this situation, we are talking about a population of people, the Palestinians, who have been displaced and massacred since 1948. And what people are not seeming to understand here is that we have to be in full support of Israel because that's what our government says, or that's what is not anti-Semitic. How do you bridge the gap between that and get people to understand that this is a war for what's right, a war for, you know, getting the Palestinians peace? Because, you know, since 1948, like their country used to be so big, now it's just stripped to Gaza. So like how do you get through to that?
Well, first of all, I am a college dropout, but I still like to do academia, and I appreciate people that I join these academic type of conversations with in spaces that I'm invited to. And one thing that I come to understand when it comes to the term anti-Semitic, they are only using one part of the definition. If you go to the dictionary and you look up the word Semitic, it says relating or I'm sorry, it says a family of languages that includes Hebrew, Arabic, Aramaic, the language that Jesus spoke, certain ancient languages such as the Polynesian, and there's another term I can't, I'm not even going to try to read that word, consulting for the main subgroup of Afro-Asiatic family. So Hebrews and Arabic speaking people are Semitic in the dictionary. Zionists are using one part of the definition to prove their case when the people they are murdering are Semitic as well too.
Wow. Wow.
I just want to make sure that people fully understand what they are saying and how they are using propaganda to change. It's alternative facts to them, basically. It's fake news. They're using fake news. Zionists, and I'm not saying Jewish people, I'm saying Zionists. Those are the people I'm targeting. Zionists are using terms and lying in their propaganda to change a narrative away from the actual reality. We all knew that Palestine has existed on maps. Hell, when you look at the biblical time, it says Palestine there. It says it. These people are indigenous to their land. And as an indigenous person who was from the Natue and Maharan tribe and Halawa Saponi up in Virginia, that's where my grandmother is from. And as a black man, an African that does not know where I come from in Africa, what language I spoke, what traditions we held, what holidays we had, it infuriates me to see people are using this type of rhetoric to justify the extermination of another indigenous culture. And it's very, very wrong. And I'm going to tell you, you're not anti-Semitic when you talk about Israel. If you solely talk about how the Israel state is doing and you solely talk about the Zionism part, you're not anti-Semitic. You have the right to critique them because what they are doing is wrong. Now, if you're going around saying what Kanye said, you are anti-Semitic.
Exactly.
You are. I think that's the best way to break it down.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it's not all Jewish people. There's black Jews, there's Arab Jews, there's great white Jews. Hell, Russia, which is a country that I have studied for years, they have a very large Jewish population. Now, let's talk about that real quick. Tsarist Russia, before the USSR, I know everybody has their differences about the USSR. We're not going to get into that. Tsarist Russia, we all agreed that the empire that was set in Russia was very barbaric before the Bolsheviks came and got rid of them. Tsarist Russia was a huge part of contributing to anti-Semitism. Huge part. Not just Germany. Not just Ukraine, and we're going, Stefan Bandera, people need to look him up, Stefan Bandera, when I talk about the anti-Semitic history in Ukraine as well, too. And we're talking about Eastern Ukraine. We're not talking about Western. Germany, of course. Anglo-Saxons as a whole, not the Slavic regions, which is up in Russia and Ukraine and Anglo-Saxons as a whole, the Germanic descended people, all of Europe was very, very anti-Semitic. They used to beat them up and attack them whenever there was an issue with, I don't know, the bubonic plague or what, the Black Death, whatever. There was always a way for them to just persecute them. So they needed to go somewhere. And that's how Zionists started. And they actually supported and loved Palestine. They actually called it Palestine. You can see it in their writings. When you look into the earlier Zionists, they were like, hey, this is where our land was biblically. Maybe we can go and coexist with them. Let's have everybody go there. This was the 1800s, the late 1800s. So when Hitler came to power, that dude is such a jerk. We all know. That's me saying it the nice way. I could say something else because my podcast is unfiltered, but I'm trying to be. So after, you know, that happened in Moscow, Russia lost the most people in that war. They lost over like 25 million people, I believe. And they were able to take Berlin and stop Hitler. Britain was the ones that were like, okay, so where are we going to put these Jewish people? We don't want them here. United States is taking scientists, Nazi scientists, and around that time they were still barring Jewish people from coming. People got to look at their history. Jewish people were barred here. They were not allowed here. They were the Mexicans of today, if you basically want to get an understand. They were hated. So they looked at Palestine and they took it to the extreme. They brought Zionists over and they killed Palestinians, the British in cahoots with the Zionists. And they call it the Nabuk, where over 77,000 Palestinians were displaced and was forced to move. Now let's fast forward today. When you look at the immigration and you look at the refugee population of cultures, Palestinians are the highest. 70% of Palestinians today are not in their homeland. They are scattered throughout the world. Scattered. So to call me anti-Semitic for people that want to say anything that you say about Israel is anti-Semitic. To call me anti-Semitic and you don't know your history, you haven't looked into that, that is the fallacy in your belief that you need to like look into, literally. Exactly. For anybody who's listening.
Exactly. In terms of the humanitarian aspect of this, more than 16,000 lives have been claimed in Palestine. This includes both women and children, including babies. Can you speak to the humanitarian impact of this war? Because, I mean, Palestine is a place that is constantly living under threat, that is constantly living under terror from Israel. So it's not like, oh, this just happened and, you know, they're dealing with the impacts. Like, this is a place that has been ravaged, that has been ransacked. Can you speak to the humanitarian aspect of this, especially because I know you're in contact with some of your Palestinian contacts?
Yeah, and let me tell you, it's very depressing what I see. It's really not. It's really sad. There are days where I literally just have to like not look at my social media. But hey, look, I'm a political commentator, so I have to also know what's going on, stay on top of things. So I space it out. Gaza is an open air prison. This has been confirmed by my old job, Amnesty International, which I have quarrels with, which is why I left, because of their ideas on certain human rights policies, which I disagree with, but that's a wholly different story. Even the Human Rights Council, HRC, I believe it's Human Rights Council. They have confirmed this. They even said that it's an apartheid state, both entities. The UN as well too has said this as well. So Gaza has, you know, there's no IDF before all this has happened. The IDF left because Hamas drove them out. No one is allowed to leave Gaza. They control all of it. They control the water supply, electricity, everything. This is why they're able to shut it off. And people should question the pro-Zionists. If they really care about the Palestinian people, why would you cut off the electricity and water? Mm-hmm. Well, have you watched Gaza Fight for Freedom documentary? People should watch that. It gives you a full understanding by Abby Martin, who I've met, very awesome woman. She's one of the best journalists that America does not deserve, Abby Martin. That's just how I feel. We don't deserve somebody that is just as talented and driven as she is. She has exposed a lot and she's banned from Israel and Gaza because of it. The IDF, they shoot you if you try to go 5 or 10 miles out into the water. You'll get shot for anything if you try to leave, any kind of way. It's constant. It's like a blockade, you know, like in security surveillance, which they boast about until after October 7th. Apparently their security surveillance wasn't strong enough to stop the Hamas attack. But now we're seeing new reports that they knew of this attack happening anyway, and they chose not to do anything about it. Egypt told them about it and stuff like that. And then, you know, it's half of the population that was during the time of 2002 when Hamas was voting into power, the only election they ever had, by the way, which tells you how suppressed they are. And they try to use that as an example to say that it's Hamas. But no, you guys did not allow them to have a democracy for how long? And you use Hamas and the PLO to go against each other. And they did. They fought each other. And the PLO stayed in the West Bank and Hamas is in Gaza. Mm-hmm. So it was all Bibi Netanyahu's plan to keep them divided, because he knew if they all stayed together. He even talks about this, by the way, guys. Just read. Look that shit up. So the West Bank is, I just cursed. I apologize. The West Bank, as well, is being attacked. In the West Bank, there's over 200, I think it's 300 now, of Palestinians. Before October 7th, after October 7th, 300 Palestinians are now detained. And Ahmed Tami, who is very well known because of her just sticking it to the IDF when she was younger, she's part of that detained population, arrested. I don't want to say detained. They're not detained. They're arrested for no charges. A lot of children are in detentions for no charges. At all. Israel is the only state that has a military court to prosecute children. Not even just prosecute, just to detain children, because they're not being prosecuted. Prosecute mean they were charged and they're waiting to you know, have the court date, and then they're going to be judged, jury, all that stuff. That doesn't go on in Israel. No, that doesn't go on in Israel. Israel, you see a Palestinian, you either shoot them or you put them in prison. That's what they do. So you're seeing kids that are coming out when they did the Hatcher swap, seeing kids that you haven't seen for years. Just like they just come out, and women, mothers, they just let them out. And then they stop it because they're saying, oh, there was a breach in the agreement or something. That's nonsense. Y'all wanted to go back to bombing Gaza anyway. You told all these people to run to the south. Where are they going to go? They can't go anywhere. Mm-hmm. And then you got this guy named Ben Gavir, who is a starch. He's a part of Bibi Netanyahu's cabinet. He's a very right wing Zionist terrorist. He has been a part of a lot of atrocities towards the Palestinian people. He's handing out guns in the West Bank to the settlers to shoot Palestinians. The IDF is looking the other way while they attack Palestinians. This video. All over the place. You want to talk about human shields? Hamas, there's no evidence that Hamas is using human shields, but there's evidence, there's videos all over talking about how TikTok, there's video of how the IDF is using children as human shields. You see them put them on the the truck? They're put on the truck. You see them hide behind them when they're pointing a gun at somebody. They're using people as human shields themselves, and they are deciding to say it's only Hamas.
Wow.
There's a lot I could talk about what's going on over there.
I know.
But it's very sad. And it's very comparable to what we went through during Jim Crow, where there's Arab-only access, Arab-only schools. They keep them divided purposely. And I need Americans to understand that part.
In terms of human rights being looked at here as an actual, plausible, logical, you know, basic human decency. Earlier, it was, I think, earlier in November or something, that the UN basically proposed this resolution for a ceasefire, and the United States denied it because we basically said that, oh, Israel, it doesn't say in the ceasefire that Israel has the right to defend itself.
Mm-hmm. That's cap, by the way.
I know. And this is such like an emotionally, you know, difficult conversation to have, and also just difficult to cover, you know, just in terms of being an observer of this.
You want me to say it?
Huh?
You want me to say it? Israel does not have the right to defend itself. Under the Geneva Convention and Article 46, they are seen as an occupying force. Occupying forces are not allowed to start wars, which it's not wars, it's genocide. They're not allowed to attack the people they are occupying. It's not a war. You're not having a war with someone you're occupying. You already won the war. Israel does not have a right to defend themselves. I'll say it. You won't get in trouble.
Wow. No, see, I didn't even know that. Because, like, I didn't even know this. Like, I'm a student of history. I definitely study history a lot. And I try to bring a lot of history on this podcast to enlighten people. And see, I did not. I was not aware of that history.
Oh, yeah. The Geneva Convention will give you a huge eye-opener of how war is supposed to be conducted. And you know, the collective punishment, by the way, that's a war crime. And that's exactly what Israel is doing, which is why they have to use the excuse of human shields to try to deflect from that. You know, you get what I'm saying? They wouldn't be saying the human shields part if they were allowed to do a collective punishment.
And I guess my last question to you is, in terms of the future and in some God glory given future, is there the potential that we will see Palestine fully get what was theirs back? Because Israel, you know, since it was formed in 1948, it started off as like this, you know, specific place for Jewish people. And now it's become so massive that Gaza is what Palestine used to be, larger. Are we going to see, do you have hope for a renewal of that? An eventual, I don't even want to say peace talks, because it's so pessimistic. What's your view for the future?
I would say that Israel's not going to be the same that it was on October the 6th. This is going to change a lot of things. Even Biden has said this, which is the only thing I agree with him with. What needs to happen is an Arab solution for Arab people. So that's what needs to happen. And it's not going to happen under this administration with Bibi. Bibi needs to get locked up, first of all. Mm-hmm. I don't think there will be any kind of talks of peace with Benjamin Netanyahu still in power, especially with the cabinet that he has as well, too. But I do think that there is a chance, just like what happened in South Africa, that this apartheid system can be demolished. I believe in that. And I believe there's a way that we could go back to where it was, where Jews and Palestinians and Muslim Palestinians and Jewish and Christian Palestinians were able to coexist in peace, because they did that. It happened for hundreds of years. Yes, there was disputes. We're humans. We all have disputes. Mm-hmm. I mean, Africa, the tribes were fighting each other 24/7. Here, tribes was fighting each other 24/7. But there wasn't a oppressive regime before the colonizers came. I'm talking about before that literally where they were just oppressing each other, putting them into circumstances, occupying each other and destroying each other's way of life. No, that wasn't a thing that existed. So I believe, just like what happened with South Africa, it took the media, it took the world to be outraged for South Africa to get better. And South Africa is not anywhere like, you know, where they want to be, but at least they are trying, and there's no apartheid. And that's where I feel that needs to happen for Palestine. And I'm very optimistic that can happen after this whole conflict. And my heart goes out to the Palestinians, especially the press, Palestinian press that I know, the journalists that I know out there, my old boss family. I'm so sad for them. You know, they lost over 70 journalists so far. So it's very, very sad what's going on. And I hope the world sees this and we do something about this.
I know I said one last question. I want to ask you this one more. Just under 2 minutes and 30 seconds. But
no problem.
In terms of what I do here on the show, and then, of course, what you do, in terms of, like, you know, activism and journalism, how do people like us with platforms that can reach people, how do we cover this war, this genocide, responsibly?
Deep question, man. Look, we all have our own point of views, and we can only put it the way that we see things. But I think the best thing that we could do is to make sure that we're centering the oppressed, in this point, the Palestinian voices. Make sure we're centering anti-Zionist Jewish people that are like the organization Jewish Voices for Peace. They are phenomenal and they're doing everything they can in America to let people know that this is not going to happen in their name. We just need to center their voices. Stop watching mainstream media. We should have stopped during the Iraq war, but clearly they found ways to get us to trust them again. Mainstream media is dead. It's all about, you know, what's real media? You. People that are out there actually trying to get make sense of it all, that are not backed by corporate donors, that are not backed by a party that is a bourgeois party like the Democrats and Republicans, that are free thinking. Tommy Nation Politics, I'm thinking about him. He's another podcaster that I talk to from Texas. Free thinking, innovative. That's what he always says. Go off of that. Trust yourself and trust the information you get on the streets.
Again, my guest is Jamar Jabari, host of the Voices of Change podcast. Mr. Jabari, thank you so much for coming on the show. It was really nice to have you.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. And definitely would love to have you on my show as well, too. So let's stay in touch.
Yes. Thank you so much, everyone, for listening to this episode of the Jeremiah Patterson Show. We are back for season 13. This is so exciting. Lots of special reports and interviews planned in a way like you've never seen on this show before. Get festive. It's the holidays. There is definitely a lot planned for this show in terms of the restructuring, as well as things are going to be changing, and a lot more one-on-one interviews and much more deep investigative journalistic episodes. So I'm definitely looking forward to that. Thank you so much again for listening, and I will see you again tomorrow for another NARP episode.